Wake up! Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. You are now listening to You and Me at 30. I'm your host, Dr. Joshua K. Wright. I realize that you could be anywhere in the world right now, but you're here listening to me, and I sincerely appreciate that. You and Me at 30 is a talk show bringing you lively, thought-provoking discussion on a variety of topics. Each show will feature an extended conversation with a guest. While many of these individuals will come from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore and the local community, I will also feature several guests from around the country. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of 91.3 WESM or the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. In 2013, I went on a life-changing trip to the West African country of Ghana. The trip was organized by Sankofa International Incorporated, a U.S.-based nonprofit established in 1993. My guest this morning is Richard Willis, the founder of Sankofa. Mr. Willis, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Josh. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So, Mr. Willis, what is Sankofa?
Sankofa is a word that comes from the Ashanti region of Ghana. And short, it means back to your roots. So a lot of African Americans embrace this word, especially when they go back to Africa, because that's exactly what they feel like, they're going back to their roots.
So you wrote a book a few years ago in which you described your first trip to Ghana. What was the name of the book?
The title of the book is When My Feet Touched the Ground, and it's a subtitle, A Matriarch's Prophecy.
First of all, why did you go to Ghana, and then what eventually led you to starting Sankofa?
I traveled to Ghana for the first time in 1994, and I went to Ghana for one reason and one reason only, and that was to make money. But when my feet touched African soil, God Almighty touched my heart. And what God did is he changed profit motive to altruism. And I call that spiritual experience number one. That same trip, I had a second spiritual experience. I met an old woman in the village of Aduma Francho in Ghana's Ashanti region. And the old woman spoke to me through her granddaughter. She was about 100 years old. She could not speak English, but her granddaughter could. And this old woman told me that my being in her village was spiritually based. And then she went on to tell me a true story that had been passed down generations through her family about seven men who came up missing over 400 years ago, and they were never seen again. The old woman told me that I was connected to these missing men, and through my spirit, these men had returned home. These two spiritual experiences that inspired me to write the novel, When My Feet Touched the Ground, A Matriarch's Prophecy. And the novel, which is based on a true story, my true story, is a journey that connects the seven missing men with me. And thus, spiritually, what it does, it connects Africa with African Americans. And I think that's even more important, because I do believe that African Americans will play a major part when it comes to returning Africa to its greatness.
So tell me, Mr. Willis, you said when you originally went to Ghana, it was solely to make money. So first of all, where are you from? And then secondly, what were you doing career-wise when you made your first trip over there in 1994?
I was born in Washington, D.C., born and raised. And in 1994, I was working for the U.S. Department of the Interior in Washington, D.C. At that time, I was a mid-level manager. And through one of my employees who worked maybe several levels beneath me, he was from Ghana, but he was now an American citizen. He told me that he was going back home the following year. And I asked him if I could go with him. And out of that, we established a partnership, an import-export business, and the trip to Africa was solely to make money.
How much did you know about Africa, and in particular Ghana, when you made that trip?
I knew absolutely nothing about Africa. I didn't care about Africa. I didn't think much about it. Before the trip, I did meet with him on many occasions because he began to talk to me about Ghana's culture and things that would be very important.
So you make the trip, you have the spiritual awakening, you know, coming from your meeting with this older woman. And then from there, take me through the process in terms of how the nonprofit actually got started and how it developed over the years.
It started out when it went there, we established an import-export business to make money. But when God touched my heart, I knew that this was going to be not-for-profit. But I didn't know what to do. I don't know what it's like really trying to help people this way. I had no idea what the needs were in Africa and how I was going to best be able to serve them. So I thought that my partner, he would be able to help me in this journey. But shortly thereafter, he told me that he wasn't going back anymore. So I decided that I was going to do it on my own. So I just went over there in the blind, depending on God to lead and guide me.
How do you get money to do the projects?
Let me say first, the Sankofa is tax exempt. We're nonprofit, 501c3 certified. But in 25 years, we have never applied for any grants or corporate sponsorship. It's all been paid out of pocket. Our work is at the grassroots level with the people there. And the only thing that I can say is my wife and I and just a handful of others, we have saved what we can in order to be able to go there and help people who are desperately in need, because they live based on survival day to day. And there's no way to get around that. They're trying to figure out how they're going to eat, how they're going to have clean water, have some clothes to wear. And so it's all been paid out of pocket.
And what are some of the types of projects that you all have done for those people over the years?
You know, we've got a number of projects. One is we've taken electricity into some of the rural areas, places where people never thought that they would see electricity. We have awarded scholarships at the high school, university levels. And in 2017, we had our first graduate with a master's degree. She graduated from the University of Ghana with a master's degree in project management. We provide food for the hungry and clothes for the needy. We have established a Sankofa showroom. What we did is we worked out business relationships with some of the people over there, some of the craftspeople, seamstresses, wood carvers, painters, and we took some seed money into their operation. They now make the goods. We bring it here and we sell it. Every dollar goes back to Africa. And that's how they eat and take care of themselves. We established Sankofa Organic International Farms to grow meat and to grow food to help feed the people. And we're in the process of putting the finishing touches on Sankofa Cares Chop Bar, which is going to be a small restaurant where we're going to feed hungry children for free. And so not only are we going to feed them physically, but we're also going to help train and develop them and also help to develop them spiritually. So these are just some of the projects. We've got many, many more.
What's been your biggest challenge over the years in terms of doing this work?
I think the biggest challenge is building relationships of trust. They don't trust us and we don't trust them. You know, I'm sure that your listening audience has heard many horror stories about Africa, and you can imagine how the people in Africa feel. So I didn't know it at the time, but it took like 20 years for me to understand that the first 10 years was really about relationship building. Once that barrier is broken, you really do have an opportunity to help the people. Another one is the culture. And, you know, in our country, we were stripped of our culture, but back in Africa, I mean, it's been in existence for thousands of years. And when you look at the culture, there are some great things about it, and then there are some things that help to keep them poor. To me, the challenge is making sure that we embrace those things that are great about the culture and to replace that knowledge and information, those things that are holding them down, to replace that with new information that helps to uplift them. I think to me, those are the two greatest challenges, and they're both long-term. And so, you know, so one of the things that we do is we conduct life management workshops that deal with problem solving and decision making, money management, strategic planning, things that, you know, these guys don't think about because their mind is on day-to-day survival.
So I want to kind of address those a little further. So with the first one, you say establishing trust, building relationships. Do you think a lot of that difficulty kind of comes from this, the history of, well, you want to talk slavery or later colonialism, and this notion of people coming from foreign lands just to exploit them as opposed to actually help them and work with them?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head. And I think another factor is the fact that most African-Americans who have gone over, we've gone over as individuals or maybe with churches, and it's been short term. Mm-hmm. So they are used to us coming and going and then not seeing us anymore. So their mind is get the money while you've got them, because they truly believe that money is the answer to their problems. Our job is to teach them that's not true, and that there are other factors. But because they see a short term, that even helps to reinforce their way of thinking.
And then the other point you mentioned, you were talking about the culture, and you said something really interesting. You said that there are certain aspects of their culture that hold them back and keep them poor. Can you explain what you mean by that?
I'm going to deal with this very humbly. The culture basically says that the man is in charge and the woman is the servant. And I mean, I have met some brilliant females in Africa who just are being underutilized because the culture says this is the part that you play. And many of them, especially those who are in poverty, they have no choice in the matter. There is a love of money. Everything centers around money, and you do what you can to get it. And, of course, because we are spiritually based, and one of the things that I'm always mentioning to them is what God says about money, which is the love of money is the root to all evil. So when you can scratch beneath the surface, if you go there and they're dealing with you at the surface level, then it looks like everything is okay. But if they open up to you where you can get beneath the surface, you see that when it comes to money, there is no trust among the people. And so because there is no trust, they don't talk about things like partnerships and, the things that we utilize to help give us a competitive advantage. You know, they are relying on their own mind and their own resources to make a difference. And the end result for that is failure.
What would you say has been your most notable success story so far?
I would go right back to the building relationships of trust. I think that is number one, because you need that in order for them to listen to you and then to try to follow you. You know, if you're over there, they will listen because they want the money and they think that that's the right thing to do to get the money. But in order to get them to follow you, they've got to trust you. And I think that's the most notable success story that we've got. And once we've got their trust, then we can talk to them about the cultural barriers. Then we can talk to them about God and the role he plays and even why we are there, because I'm there for God. It's not even for me.
How often do you go back and forth between the U.S. and Ghana?
I'm in Ghana at least 3 times a year. Normally when I go, it's for a couple months at a time, which is something that they're not used to seeing. And that's been a big advantage.
So I want to play devil's advocate for just a moment. In 2007, Oprah Winfrey, the billionaire, opened her Leadership Academy for Girls in South Africa. So some people criticize Oprah for not using her money to focus more on helping less fortunate young black girls and youth in general, young black youth here in America. So what do you say to anyone who would ask you, why are you choosing to focus so much on the folks in Ghana when you could be helping people back here in D.C., Baltimore, Maryland, Eastern Shore, et cetera?
My response is always the same. And number one, it's not my choosing. It's my calling. And so the work that I do in Africa, it's out of obedience to God. And if I was trying to do the same thing outside of Africa, I know that it would fail because it wouldn't have God's anointing over it. My other comment is that while I am committed to the work that I do in Africa, I do give back in other ways as well. And it's just that, you know, it's done humbly. And so I don't think that people should assume that because they witness one project that they think that's all a person does. I'm not one dimensional. It's much more than that.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to UMES 30. Today's guest is Mr. Richard Willis, the founder of Sankofa International Incorporated, a nonprofit that's been assisting individuals and families in Ghana since 1993. Mr. Willis, what are some myths that people still have about Ghana in particular and Africa in general?
You know, I really don't deal with Africa that way that much. I'm not really sure if I'm qualified to talk at that level. I will say this about how Africans see us. They think that all Americans are wealthy. And so when you talk to them about the struggles of the U.S., that's just something that goes in one ear and out of the other. Because they feel like we're all wealthy, then they think that it is okay to take our money, because what they truly believe in their hearts is that we can always get more. I'm not really sure how Americans feel about Africa, because I really haven't spent a lot of time dealing with Africa that way. My focus has just been more on trying to do the things that are required to help return Africa to its greatness, starting at the grassroots level.
Right. You know, and I brought up that question just because I know listening to my dad and elders talk, they would tell me how if you were black and you were growing up in the 40s, 50s, 60s, you know, Africa was kind of this dark jungle. That's what they were taught from looking at movies such as Tarzan and watching television. And they didn't really have anything such as an African-American history course that was being taught in schools back then. So they had this very negative view about Africa. And even recently, I was talking to an older gentleman in his 70s, a black American, and he still had that very negative view of Africa. And he was saying how, well, all the people there, they just, you know, they practice the voodoo and, they're just bad people. And, they sold their ancestors into slavery and they're still untrustworthy. So that's why I was bringing that up, because, I know there's still some people who have a negative view of Africa, and even African-Americans who dislike Africans today, they don't like them for whatever reason.
Yeah. I can say this, that, like your dad and, because I'm in that same generation, I remember the Tarzan movies, but I never really thought much of it. I think what helped me with the myths is that I went from not thinking about Africa at all to being in Africa. So, there wasn't that all of that cloudy mess in the middle. I'm there. I'm touching the people. I'm seeing it with my own eyes. Now there's no reason for myths. Everything there now is real. Yes. And so I didn't get a chance to experience that.
In 2013, I went to Ghana with you in a small group. And as I said at the start of the show, it was a life-changing experience for me. That was my first time being there. And, it really opened my eyes to a lot. It was moving, having a chance to go into some of the less fortunate villages and give books and supplies to the school children and to meet with some of the elders and the Queen Mother, and also just to see the country itself. Another thing that really stood out to me was when we visited the slave castle, the Amina slave castle, and going in those dungeons where they held the men and the women, and just trying to imagine what that would have been like, being in this castle prior to going off on the Middle Passage and then being taken out to, be a slave in the Americas if you're able to survive the Middle Passage. So when you take people on these trips, what are some of the things that people often tell you during the trips and once they've completed the trip?
I can tell you that, first of all, and I think it connects back to the myths, because most of the people who have traveled with us really operated under the myths that you spoke about. But, I can say that, one, I believe that every African-American should put his or her feet on African soil. And, in 2004, we led our first group to Africa, and it proved to be life-changing. And it wasn't life-changing because of us. It was life-changing because God has his anointing in what we are doing. And I have come to understand just how important these trips are in getting more and more African-Americans to understand the real part that they're going to play in this long-term journey. Since then, we've had 11 different groups, and we do it with no advertising. We have right now, we've got trips scheduled through 2021. What's great about the journeys is, I think, one, it cancels out all of those myths that people had. And you get a chance, like you said, to go to the Amina capsules, and you see that door of no return, and you see how the captured Africans lived down in the dungeons, and how, you know, their captors lived above them. They were just above them, you know, with all of that suffering going on, you know, beneath their feet. To visit places like Asin Manso, which is where the last bath in Slave River. So that's where the Africans took their last bath before they were taken into the dungeons. But like you said, what we also do is, because we're anchored so well at the grassroots level, we rub elbows with everyday people in the rural villages. So to be able to get into the chief's quarters and meet with the queen mothers and the elders, to see mud huts that are older than our country, you know, to visit village schools and be able to interact with the students. And I think, and on top of that, they get to see another piece of Africa. And that is, once the day is done, we go back to 4-star hotels, mm-hmm. where people get a chance to rest in air-conditioned rooms with hot waters, and we eat at 4-star restaurants, and the food. I mean, if you have money, the food is so much better. It's so fresher. There's no additives and preservatives. I mean, it's just it's a healthier environment once you can get through the mess. And at the end of the day, I can say this, when our people are leaving, you see lots of tears on both sides. And the reason you see those tears is because relationships have been built, and they're going to last for a lifetime. So I think that those are just some of the reasons why people go. And while we have repeat travelers, I mean, because some people have been, every time we do a group trip, some people have gone on every trip. And so, again, it's not because of us, it's because of God.
Right. And let me just reiterate that point for all of our listeners. You know, as Mr. Willis said, everybody should visit Africa, or a country in Africa, at least once, especially if you are a person of African descent. You know, earlier in the episode, we talked about there being a disconnect between African-Americans and Africans. If you saw the film Black Panther, which was really popular last year, the Marvel Comics movie, you remember the primary antagonist in the film, Eric Killmonger, played by Michael B. Jordan, and how he felt cut off from his roots and his culture and his history because he had grown up in the Americas and he had never actually been over in Africa. So I'm not saying it's that extreme for the average listener, but what Mr. Willis is saying is very true. You know, if you've never been to Africa, I mean, when you go there for that first time, you do feel a connection to the continent. And it's really hard to describe it over the airwaves. It's just something, like they say, you have to experience for yourself. Yeah. And everybody's experience is going to be different based on, you know, what your own outlook and where you are in life at that time when you make that trip. But it really is something that I would encourage everybody to do. Mr. Willis, how often did you travel overseas prior to your first trip to Ghana?
It was very limited. You know, Africa was really my first international experience.
Why do you think it's important for Americans, regardless of race, ethnicity, gender, why do you think it's important for Americans to view themselves as global citizens?
You know, I think it's critical, and, you know, not just global citizens, but then to travel abroad. And one of the reasons is because no matter how you see this country, we are blessed by God here. And, you know, we ought to use our blessings to bless others. And to me, traveling abroad gives us a better appreciation for our blessings and will give us a better understanding of how we can be a blessing to others. I just think we've got to get out of this U.S. mentality that we are more global, that spiritually speaking, God intended us to be more global. And I believe with all my heart that especially African-Americans, we're going to change that continent. So not just to be global citizens, but to also travel abroad, to see it with your own eyes, to touch it with your own hands, And I think you're better off if you're traveling with someone who is anchored. It doesn't have to be Sankofa, but, you know, love for you to look in our direction. But I think it's a mistake just to get on the airplane and go. And I have met people who are adventuresome that way. And that's what you are. That's what you are. But you got to be careful. It's nothing to play with. And so it's something to be taken very seriously when you decide to travel.
Right. And I would say that when I went on my trip with you, it ran smoothly. But a big reason for that was because there had been so much proper planning. I mean, there was more than a year's worth of planning. You know, we knew what immunizations we needed to take. We knew what types of pills we needed to take while we were over there. You know, we knew about the food, the travel itself. I mean, it's a process. Like you say, it's not as though you're just going to Vegas for a weekend. I mean, this is a process. Yeah. And if you're going to do it right, then you do have to prepare properly. Mr. Willis, we're almost out of time, but I'd be remiss if I didn't offer my condolences on the passing of Reverend Edward Hackney. Why was Reverend Hackney so important to Sankofa and to you?
Yeah, well, Reverend Hackney was a dear friend, and he was with Sankofa from day one. He had a passion for helping Africans in Africa. He traveled to Africa with us some 11 times. He had a serious relationship with Africans in Africa, and they were heartbroken to hear his death. And he's a dear friend. He was a great resource to Sankofa, and he will be missed.
Well, Mr. Willis, thank you again for joining me today. Is there any way that listeners can support the work you're doing with Sankofa or even attend one of your international trips?
Yes, and I would say probably the best way right now is to contact me at the phone number 202-257-4364. And when we communicate that way, I can direct you to the website and give you all the information that you need just based on what you feel your particular interests are.
Well, again, Mr. Willis, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure, and God bless you for the work that you're doing.
We end each show with a segment called Parting Shots. Here I give my thoughts on something happening in the news, pop culture, or life in general that's piqued my interest. On June 16th, Lonnie Bunch became the 14th secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. Bunch, formerly the founding director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., is the first African American to lead the Smithsonian and the first historian elected secretary. In addition, he will be the first museum director to ascend to secretary in the last 74 years. Mr. Bunch, a New Jersey native, attended Howard University before transferring to American University in D.C., where he earned his bachelor's and master's degree in American history and African history. And we, you know, definitely wish Mr. Bunch all the luck in his new role as the secretary at the Smithsonian. And that's our show for the week. Thanks again to our guest today. We do this every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it. Like us on Facebook and other forms of social media. A special shout out, as always, to Uncle Phil and Aunt Viv. Have a blessed day.
Listen to this or any past episode of UMES 30 by logging on to WESM913.org or through the NPR One app available for download on Google Play. UMES 30 is produced in the studios of 91.3 WESM, located on the campus of the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. The views and opinions expressed on UMES 30 are not necessarily those of 91.3 WESM or the University of Maryland Eastern Shore.